Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That American Express credit card company you may have dealt with in the past, well, today it's a bank and in line to get some of that federal bailout money. Meanwhile, one of the country's four big banks is offering a bailout of its own. Citibank says it's joining other big lenders in halting many home foreclosures. Peter Coy is economics editor for Business Week. And Peter, let's start with American Express. What was behind the move to, move to declare itself a bank?
We have to go back to what's happening with credit card companies in general, which is that default rates, delinquency rates are rising. For a long time, even after this credit crunch began, people were keeping up on their payments pretty well. And the funny thing is that even after people started defaulting on their mortgages, they still kept paying on their credit cards because I think they consider them more of a real lifeline. Mm. But now we're getting to the point where this credit crunch has gotten so bad that they can't even keep up on their credit cards.
Well, American Express is now subject to full federal oversight because it has declared itself a bank. What does American Express get in return?
They get access to the Fed's discount window at which it can borrow at 1.5%. The problem it's been having is that it and other credit card lenders have not had good access to the commercial paper market for short-term borrowing, and they've had trouble securitizing their credit card receivables, which has been a critical avenue for them to raise money to extend new credit to people.
And we're just going to briefly touch on that. That means sort of bundling their assets and selling them, making some money on them?
Right, so that when you make a payment on your credit card, the money passes through American Express's hands but then goes right back out the back door to some holder of a asset-backed security.
Right.
People aren't willing to buy those asset-backed securities either at all, or at least they're demanding very high rates on them, which in turn forces American Express and other credit card lenders to raise the rates they charge.
Well, does this also mean American Express is going to get in line for some federal aid, and won't they then have to get behind Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and other giants who went from private to commercial in September to also get some of this federal money?
They're not behind them. They're at the same level, I would say. They're within the inner ramparts now of the financial system, which is a safe place to be. The irony, of course, is that as the Fed and the Treasury attempted to wall off certain parts of the financial system from harm, anybody who was outside of those walls became more vulnerable. So everybody's scrambling, knocking on the door, let us in, let us in.
Well, that is an irony because initially it was almost like the federal government had to strong arm some banks to become part of the bailout. And now, as you say, banks are feeling, well, wait a minute, if I'm not part of the bailout, somebody may look at me as vulnerable.
Exactly. Right. It's an unintended consequence.
Well, let's move to Citigroup. That bank announced today that it's joining some other major lenders in trying to help homeowners at risk of foreclosure. What exactly is it saying?
Citigroup is doing the same thing that a lot of other banks have done, which is simply to say, look, let's be realistic here. Some of these people just can't pay at the rates they're being charged on their loans. So we'll try to cut them a deal. We'll try to lower the amount they owe, because we'd rather do that than to foreclose on them and be stuck with a piece of property that we really don't want and can't sell.
Is this a sign that some of the federal bailout of banks is finally getting trickling down to the homeowner? Because Citigroup was a part of the government bailout. Is that one of the reasons Citigroup is able to do this, that they have some, some more federal backing right now?
I think so. You know, one of the provisions is that banks' debt is guaranteed for a certain period of time, which helps lower their borrowing costs, gives them the financial strength to do some things like this, to reach out, be more aggressive about renegotiating loans with homeowners without worrying so much that it's going to cause a write-off that'll weaken their capital structure.
Well, where do Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae fit into today's news? Because they are now government-backed, but they're not government agencies. They still have stockholders, and these were supposed to be the agencies that helped lower-income Americans in particular get mortgages, but we're hearing anecdotally from housing advocates that they're the least likely to want to renegotiate mortgages with swamped homeowners. So, where do they fit in all this?
I think the outcome of the Fannie and Freddie stuff has been a big disappointment to almost everybody, because they haven't really, as you say, become part of the solution. To me, they're almost still more part of the problem right now. And perhaps the solution is to take the final step and just make them part of the government, just acknowledge that this in-between status is doing nobody any good.
And they wouldn't be looking at a bottom line of the stockholders and CEO salaries, frankly. They'd be operating like a government agency.
Exactly.
Peter Coy, economics editor for Businessweek magazine. Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, a new public service campaign to help veterans connect with each other online through social networking sites was launched today. We'll link you at our website, here-now.org. Of course, vets traditionally have met in halls, and decades ago, they found another connection.
Kaserne vor dem großen Tor stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor.
It was a song born out of World War I, but it took on a life during World War II. It was a German song that Allied soldiers searched the radio dial to hear. And there are now dozens of versions, but the author of the original words considered them so personal, he didn't want them published ever. Well, now, Lily Marlane is a book, a fascinating tale of the history of the song. And on this Veterans Day, we're joined by the 20-something authors, Liel Leibovitz, welcome.
Thank you.
And Matthew Miller, welcome to you as well, both
Thank
in
you.
The studio with us. Matt, what drew you to this story? Why? Why Lily Marlane?
I was reading a book, The Memoirs of Fitzroy McLean, who was the inspiration for James Bond, British super spy, 1942, behind enemy lines in North Africa. And he was writing about the loneliness and how desperate the situation seemed at the time, and that the only thing that really gave him joy, that he could really look forward to and kind of ground him, was a song that was played out of enemy radio, Radio Belgrade, every night at 9:57, and it was Lily Marlene, a German song. And I thought to myself, this is so strange, I've never heard this story. So I asked Liel about it, if he'd ever heard of this song, Lily Marlene, and he said he had. His grandmother used to sing it to him. And just a little more searching, we realized there was actually a great story behind the song.
Well, you learned the song was actually a poem written by a World War I sentry.
Hans Leip, he was a bohemian prototype who really deeply opposed the war and found himself one evening standing in front of the barracks gate in Berlin. And here he is, and to his left there's the officer's quarter, and there's light and happiness and music. And to his right is the train station, which, you know, picks up fresh young men to battle every week and then returns kind of like mangled corpses. And he's standing there underneath the lamplight, which is the first line of the song, and thinking about the time when the war would end, when he would come back to engage in the one activity that he liked most, which was womanizing. And he made this composite character out of two lovers he had, Lily, who was his landlord's daughter, and Marlene, who was this free-spirited art student who he'd met and had a fling with.
Tell us the lines of the poem. Why don't you do that? Can you read us some of the first few lines?
Well, I'm reading from the English translation that Marlene Dietrich made famous, but it says, underneath the lamplight by the barracks gate, darling, I remember how you used to wait. And it's really the story of a young woman waiting there underneath the lamplight for her lover to come back from the war, sort of assuming, as Hans Leip did when he wrote it, that the war would only last a few weeks and then normal life would resume. Which obviously was not the case with World War I.
Twenty years later, it's turned into the song we know by Norbert Schultz, who writes the music, and it's recorded by Lala Anderson. But when it was first broadcast, it was November 9th, 1938, and it was the first night of Kristallnacht. So
yeah, not the best timing for a love song.
Well, there you have it. I mean, Kristallnacht, of course, when thousands of German Jews were arrested, deported, their synagogues, homes, businesses destroyed. Yeah, not the best time to introduce a love song.
The recording sold less than 300 copies and was turned down originally by nearly 30 recording companies.
So, Matt, tell us, where does it go next?
What actually happened was, as the Germans began occupying more and more countries, when they occupied Yugoslavia, they needed to set up a radio station. A young German whose passion was radio and who hated war himself, his name was Karl-Heinz Reintgen. He was tasked with setting up a radio station. He remembered a friend of his in Germany liked this song, and that friend was in North Africa at the moment. They put it into the rotation because they don't have that much to work with, and all of a sudden, they start getting letters from the front, from the Africa Corps. We love this song. Please play it again. It just became so popular. It really took on a life of its own.
And they played it every night before the evening news at 10 p.m.
But soon, Radio Belgrade's signal starts to reach Allied forces. These are soldiers who don't speak German. So what was the appeal for them?
There are several answers to this. I think the first and sort of most common one is that if you listen to the melody, it's sort of like a perfect combination between a folk tune, a love song, and like a children's ditty almost. And it has a sort of like universal, almost like in terms of, you know, computers, almost this open source type of mentality into which you could write your own lyrics. And this is something that Matt and I found out when we were sort of, you know, darting across Europe. We discovered after 2 or 3 days that we were actually communicating with one another through the song. You know, I would say something like, hey, Matthew Miller, why don't you do some work? And it was really kind of amazing to discover that we were getting so into this and writing our own lyrics. But then we realized, of course, this is what the soldiers themselves had done, because many of them did not understand the lyrics, but understood that this was a sweet, sentimental song.
Well, and let's listen to a version that the soldiers of the 8th English Army did. They retell their conquest of Africa in the song. And as you say, they sort of, you know, filled in their own lyrics. Let's listen to that.
Oh, soldiers, never die. They're in the 8th Army.
Out in the desert, the lonely sentry stood, thinking of hatchet and a possible Christmas pud. But he went.
There's something there, obviously. It tapped the zeitgeist. But what else was it that pulled these soldiers?
Well, I think one of the things is that this song is really fundamentally different than songs that are usually popular during wartime. I mean, if you look at the other songs that were sort of hits during World War II, you have things either very triumphalist marches like "We're Gonna Hang Our Washington in the Siegfried Line," or you have songs like, you know, "We'll Meet Again," which are very sentimental and full of like pathos. But this one, it was so simple and straightforward and very clearly about a woman. Even if you didn't know the lyrics, you understood that Lili Marleen was a girl.
Wasn't it for, you write for many, you know, the woman they left behind?
The woman they left behind, or the woman they were looking forward to coming back to, even if they had none back home.
Well, like a musical pinup girl.
Yeah.
Something for everyone.
It was not viewed favorably by higher-ups on either side. Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister and arbiter of culture, tried to have it suppressed. Why, by the way, Matt, did he not like it?
It didn't have the sentimentality of fire, of steel, that he wanted Nazi music to have. Goebbels, for example, had written lyrics to be put to music for all the different Nazi invasions. And Norbert Schulze, who composed Lili Marleen, also wrote, you know, "Tanks Across Africa," "Bombs Over England." So this is kind of the music that he thought the soldiers should be listening to in the field, not sentimental love songs about the war ending and everyone getting back together.
And Lille, Allied officers hated it because it was a German song.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to English minds, you know, kind of accustomed to the World War I model, a good soldier song was something like "It's a Long Way to Tipperary," something that it's very patriotic, that's very clearly English. And here comes this song that is in German, that is played every day at 9:57 on the Nazi-run Radio Belgrade. At some point in 1943, when they realized the song was unstoppable and they couldn't just suppress, you know, the soldiers listening to it, they commissioned an army officer by the name of Tommy Connor to say, you go out and you have a weekend, record a version in English. We need to put something out there.
Underneath the lantern by the barricade.
And this is a version of that translation. It was recorded by Anne Shelton. But then so many more English versions followed, of course, Marlene Dietrich, June Carter Cash, Carly Simon, as we're going to hear. We'll do that in just a minute. But later today, we also wanted to tell you we have a story of an unsung hero from the Vietnam War. We'll have that as well. Back in a minute here now. Welcome back. We've been speaking with Leah Leibovitz and Matt Miller, the two young authors of the new book, Lili Marleen. It's about the song loved by both German and Allied soldiers during World War II. It was originally recorded and often performed for German soldiers by Lala Anderson. But Leah, as you mentioned, Marlene Dietrich recorded the song in English. It became her signature song. This is her version.
Outside the barracks, by the corner light, I'll always stand and wait for you at night. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. For you, Lili Marleen.
Now this is much more sentimental.
It was also recorded post-war.
Ah.
By then it has become an artifact, like a musical memento of the war.
Well, what happened to Hans Leip, who wrote the words, Norbert Schulze, who wrote the music, Lala Anderson, who sang it? you know, how were they viewed? Were they seen as collaborators?
Well, I think that's actually at least my personal favorite thing about the book is that we got into writing this book kind of having a very clear idea that the heroine would be Lala Anderson, who stood up to the Nazis, and the villain would be Norbert Schulze, who kind of, you know, collaborated with Goebbels and was a Nazi party member. And when we started doing a little bit of research, we understood that, that their fates were actually much more complicated than that. Lala Anderson had many Jewish lovers and eventually was put in a position where she couldn't collaborate with the Nazis anymore and suffered a terrible, terrible fate. She tried to escape to her Jewish lover in Switzerland, was apprehended by the Gestapo in the mountain passes in the Alps, and sort of in a very Casablanca-like move, returned to Germany on the train and sort of court-martialed and tried to kill herself shortly thereafter and ended the war exiled on an island in the North Sea. And Norbert Schulze, who, when the war began, was a sort of committed anti-Nazi and, in fact, lost a job once because he stood up to the Nazi orchestra manager, found himself in a very eerie position because he was essentially told by Goebbels, look, you have two options here. You either collaborate with us and become sort of like the house composer for the army, or you go to the Eastern Front, where the best you could look forward to is dying. He obviously, you know, chose the former. But when the war ended, him, who had lived throughout the war in great comfort, you know, in an apartment in Berlin, was all of a sudden seen as a traitor and stood trial and worked for, I believe, more than a year in construction.
He was also forbidden from performing for years, so he'd gone along with the Nazis, and when they lost, Schulze did too. But what about Hans Leip?
Hans Leip, the song was so personal for him, and he was so, it was so difficult for him to part with it and even to see it published. He was actually really revolted that it became famous only through another war. I mean, the whole point of Lili Marlene is that there would be an end to war and people can just be together and, you know, be happy. So he actually moved to a small mountain valley away from everything where he couldn't receive radio signals. He wouldn't have to listen to Lili Marlene. And when Eisenhower was in the area, he found out that Hans Leip, the lyricist of Lili Marlene, lived nearby. And he sent one of his men to the house, knocked on the door. Hans Leip's maid opens the door. Well, Mr. Leip is sleeping at the moment. So he returns to Eisenhower and says, well, he's sleeping, but we could probably go wake him up anyway. And Eisenhower turns to the man and says, no, he's the only German that's given us anything good in the past few years. Let's just let him sleep.
Huh.
Even when he returned to Hamburg after the war, when it was occupied by the British, he went up to his old house and he knocked on the door. And an English officer opened and said, well, yes, now this is the headquarters. This is, you know, where we're staying at the moment. And Hans Leip said, well, I'm not asking for my house back, but if you don't mind, if I could just take a few things. And through conversation, it turned out that this is the man who wrote Lili Marlene. The Englishman said, well, in that case, we're going to be leaving. You know, welcome home, Mr. Leip.
What a story. One song.
Yeah.
Well, all these storylines. And again, poor Hans Leip, because it not only became famous, it was recorded and re-recorded. There's so many versions. Just to listen to a few, there's a Japanese version from Kanchi Michi. We have June Carter, Kid Creole, Perry Como, and Carly Simon.
There was free lunch and beer and recreation at the wedding of Lili Marlene. Men who
saved her, Lili Marlene,
waits for a boy who marched away. And though he's gone, she hears him say,
there we create a world for two. I'd wait for you the whole night through. Was there?
I think Carly Simon, among the contemporary ones, is one of my favorites. I think she brings a sort of, you know, soulfulness and kind of quiet, melancholy approach to the song that I think the song deserves.
It might be a generational thing. I'm just wondering if, you know, your parents' generation, for instance, would say, oh, no, Lala, you know, or Marlene.
It's usually Marlene Dietrich. Yeah. That's the one most people think, oh, usually you wrote a book about Marlene Dietrich. Well, she's in the book.
But interestingly enough, I think most people, the original version is the version I think most people like least. And this goes again to why the song was successful. I think that the most characteristic thing about Lala Anderson is that she actually has a terrible voice. She sort of like enunciates the words not melodiously at all. She sort of speaks and spits them out.
The Lala Anderson version, it's so human.
Right.
It's so fragile. And I think for a soldier, maybe that meant something. It wasn't produced. It wasn't
Sure.
It's so sophisticated.
She speaks the lyrics.
She's just one of them.
And if you're in a foxhole, you'd be spitting out words too. I mean, that's probably
yeah. And that voice tears you up. I mean, one of the, I think, the most emotional moments reporting the book, we went to meet with a man who's now in his 90s called Rudolf Schneider, who was Erwin Rommel's personal driver. And he told us many stories, but one of the sentences that, you know, stuck in my mind, he said, "I have seen men crushed by tanks. I have seen men shot. I have seen men burned to death. But the only time I've seen men cry is when Lili Marlin came on the radio." And I think that really sort of captures the power that song had.
Well, and you end the book with the scene of veterans of the North Africa campaign from both the British and German sides. And of course, what song did they choose to sing?
Lili Marlin.
Yeah.
Every year since 1952.
Leah Leibovitz and Matthew Miller, their book is Lili Marlin. Who knew? What a history. Thanks so much for uncovering it for us.
Thank you.
Lala Anderson, and we'll have all the Lili Marlin versions at our website, here-now.org. Still ahead today, some thoughts on veterans' benefits after the news, here and now. It's portrait season in the nation's capital, with outgoing members of the sitting administration now sitting to preserve their images for posterity. The Washington Post reported last month that official portraits of agency heads can cost anywhere from $7,500 to the nearly $50,000 earmarked for a painting of former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. His new portrait will hang in a Pentagon hallway lined with paintings, including one of Rumsfeld from his first stint leading the Pentagon in 1975. Stephen Paulson is painting Rumsfeld's new portrait, as well as one of former Secretary of State Colin Powell. Stephen joins us now, and we're on your website, which we'll link to listeners at ours, here-now.org. And the portraits you've done are beautiful. There's a sort of Rembrandt-like, muted, very textured-looking quality to them. And I understand that you were inspired by Rembrandt.
Absolutely. Rembrandt is one of a number of great masters that I admire.
And we understand it's a pretty bipartisan thing to do these portraits. There's Madeleine Albright, I see, standing there. There's Bill Richardson. But what did your friend say when you said you were going to paint Secretary Rumsfeld?
You know, people were amazed, and you know, that he was even getting his portrait done.
Well, controversial Secretary of Defense, architect of a very controversial war, and we understand they gasped in horror. Let's just be blunt about it. But how did you feel about doing his portrait?
Well, I was happy to get the commission. If he were entirely responsible for a war that everybody felt was completely wrong, you know, I might be unsure about it. But I mean, he was one among many who worked on this war. I'm not 100% sure how I feel about the war. He's really a patriot, as are all the other people who serve us in government. He's a very nice person. He's very, very easy to spend time with.
Well, in his defense, he didn't want to do the portrait either. Apparently his staff said he should. And I'm seeing another one here that apparently won you the job. It's of General James Jones, the commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, and it's beautiful. He's in a full formal dress and
right.
Leaning against a mantle. It's really exquisite.
Thank you.
So what happens? Let's take Rumsfeld, for example. You obviously meet with them, but how do you work with them while you're making the portrait?
Usually I meet with the subject the day before. I take pictures and have a good long talk with them about what they may have in mind for a portrait, if anything. We discuss what kind of clothing and background would be in the portrait. Where the portrait's going to hang is very important. It has to really fit a certain format. It's not trying to be fine art. You know, it's got to really, really look right.
Well, when you say it's not trying to be fine art, what do you mean? Because again, I said, you know, the work of yours that I'm looking at, it does look like fine art. I mean, some of the portraits are stunning. They could be hanging in a museum. So what do you mean?
I want my paintings to be beautiful. I want people to look at them and maybe learn something about the person painted. I guess I'm talking about contemporary art, you know, which doesn't conform to any sort of rules. Here there's a format. The portrait has to be within a certain size. It has to be framed a certain way. So that's considered before I paint the portrait, before I take photos of the subject.
And when you're actually working with the subject, we know, for instance, you painted former Senator Trent Lott and got into a conversation about health care reform. And you were asking, gee, why didn't the Republicans take any significant action on health care? And he said what?
He said, we screwed up.
So you have these intimate, you know, conversations with people while you're capturing maybe not just their physicality, but some of their thoughts.
Well, you know, that all depends. I like to engage them in something that they know about. Sometimes I might want to stir up a little trouble just to see how they react, to see how they move, just to learn a little bit more about their facial expressions. It's all to make a better portrait.
So what did you say to Donald Rumsfeld?
I did not bring up the subject of the war. And if we were going to talk about it, I thought it'd be better if he brought it up.
What did you do with him then to stir up a little trouble, or at least get that, what you're talking about, that glint in the eye maybe?
In this case, I didn't have to really engage him in conversation. He has a long-time assistant. She actually has a degree in art history, a master's, and she actually got involved in the photo shoot and talked with him while I was taking photographs of him so that he could look natural. We didn't want him to just be sitting still. We wanted maybe just a little hint of a gesture or maybe the feeling that he was about to talk. That was the concept. We wanted something that seemed active, because that really would express who he is. I mean, he can't sit still for a minute. He's very he's action oriented.
What about Colin Powell? Was he chatty, pensive?
I would say he's more pensive, but very, very friendly and a good sense of humor also. I took what I thought were very good photos the first time. And something went wrong with the camera. The photos didn't come out so well on film. They were slightly underexposed. And I had to call back and have him pose again. And he just said, well, it's a good thing you're not a photographer. he's a good guy. He's been very patient. That portrait should be done soon.
Well, soon, as you're reminded that you have to get back and work. Well, there's been controversy, as you know, Stephen, about the cost of these portraits. And Jimmy Carter famously ordered his cabinet to take photographs instead. But isn't that, given the times and given the economy, isn't that a better idea? I mean, and given that this is the modern age and photography is considered fine art as well.
Oh, well, I mean, there's photography is a great visual form, you know, but I personally don't think it, you know, photos have the strength and beauty of painting. I think that there's more gravitas, I mean, if for lack of a better word, and people tend to look at them more. And in doing that, they connect people. They help to connect people with the history of the country. When you walk, the only way I could convince somebody that painted portraits are worth doing is to tell them to go into a government building and to just look and photos have been done from time to time. People will choose to have a photographer, and I don't think that they're as interesting. Visiting a government building certainly wouldn't be as interesting or as warm an experience without painted portraits on the walls.
Stephen Paulson, New Jersey-based portrait artist who's currently working on portraits of both Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell. Stephen, thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
And a quick note here. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the U.S. Constitution gives every president the power to grant pardons for offenses against the United States. We'll take a look at presidential pardons past and also ask who has George Bush already pardoned and who else might get a reprieve. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. The U.S. government spends about $73 billion a year on benefits for the country's 25 million veterans, most of that money going to health care and pensions, but also vocational training and college tuition. But veterans have to deal with an immense bureaucracy to access benefits. Peter Gayton is trying to cut through that red tape with his new book, For Service to Your Country, The Insider's Guide to Veterans Benefits. We thought we'd get a few thoughts from him on this Veterans Day. Peter works for the American Legion and also served in the Air Force during the 90s. People assume that veterans automatically have access to veterans' health care, but that's not necessarily the case. So who does qualify?
Well, you're right, Robin. That is not the case. The Department of Veterans Affairs, a secretary 6 years ago, decided to create priority groups to determine their eligibility. Those priority groups are determined by disability level, time in service, and also your income level. I myself served in the United States Air Force, but I cannot access the very healthcare system that was developed to treat the unique needs of America's service members.
Tell us, even if someone now is in need of VA healthcare now, which, as you're saying, you're not, can they always access it?
Well, let me explain how that would happen. We're having a new era of veterans coming back from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if they do have a service-connected disability, they develop a claim that will be submitted to the Department of Veterans Affairs and adjudicated by them to determine their service-connected disability.
Peter, I'm wondering if here's where you run into a snag, because we've done a lot of stories on this. There are troops coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan with shrapnel in their head and being told that it was a pre-existing condition and being denied benefits.
We are seeing some issues with VA's determination of service connectability. And what you just stated about shrapnel in any part of a returning service member, that should be identified by the Department of Veterans Affairs as a disability due to combat. And I urge any veteran who has a specific issue and is concerned about their specific claim to contact the American Legion in their state. And the American Legion, as I said, can assist them in developing that claim and getting access to that health care that they've rightly earned through their service to this country.
With a relatively new category of injury, the traumatic brain injury, the post-traumatic stress disorder, what do you recommend to these troops returning that they do to get the best benefits?
Every veteran who comes home from any deployment, all they want to do is go home. They want to be home. They want to see their families. So what DOD and VA should do is improve that screening process for traumatic brain injury and for PTSD when they're returning, when they're demobilizing.
So you're saying that, you know, with this early screening, there's also a record down the road if somebody does have a problem, the military can look back and say, oh, yeah, look, he was in this situation, and they can trace the troops better.
Exactly. Record keeping during that initial screening when they return from combat, that record keeping ensures that their claim will be to the level that it needs to be for VA to recognize their disability and for them to receive the health care and often compensation that they've deserved because they were injured in war.
There's a complaint about the slowness in dealing with claims, and you say that one of the reasons is the way Congress allocates funding to the VA.
Exactly. What we're dealing with right now with the way Congress allocates funding, it leaves VA without a budget for up to 5 months into the fiscal year. So you have VA healthcare facility administrators operating on a budget from the prior year. They can't determine how much they can spend on hiring full-time employees and purchasing new equipment and resources to help treat those patients that are waiting in line. We'd like to see VA's budget approved 2 years in advance to treat those patients in a timely manner and reduce that wait time that veterans are seeing at many, many facilities nationwide.
Well, I want to just make sure that we've touched on tuition benefits. There's a new GI Bill Congress passed this year. How does that change benefits for college tuition?
A lot of the new veterans are coming back and they're married, they have young families. They cannot choose to be a full-time student. What the new GI Bill does is give them full tuition, a monthly stipend, which is equal to the basic housing allowance of an E-5 in active duty military, and it also pays for their books and supplies.
Well, we should say the current GI Bill, the Montgomery Bill, covered just about half the national average cost of tuition, but the new one pays for the full cost of public college tuition, we
yes.
should say.
Yes, it does.
And throws in $1,000 a year for books and a monthly living stipend.
And those new benefits go a long way in allowing a veteran to choose to go to school full-time so they can get that degree, so they can provide for their families.
Peter Gayton, co-author of the book For Service to Your Country, The Insider's Guide to Veterans Benefits from the American Legion. Peter, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And again, a reminder that the standing benefits right now still really benefit people who maybe want to go to vocational school or go to school part-time, so check them out. Up next, one of the greatest war veterans you may never have heard of in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. The order was simple. Hold and die. He held, but he didn't die, and became what his comrades call one of the greatest war heroes you've never heard of. It was April 1972. 20,000 North Vietnamese forces launched an offensive designed to reach Saigon. At the town of Dong Ha, the North Vietnamese troops and tanks were poised to sweep across a key bridge and penetrate further into the south. Just 700 South Vietnamese Marines and their few American advisors, including John Ripley, stood in the way. And what Ripley did on Easter Sunday 1972 has become part of Marine Corps lore. John Ripley died on October 28th of this year. He was buried with full military honors at the U.S. Naval Academy. He was 69. John Grider Miller is a retired Marine colonel who also served as an advisor to the South Vietnamese Marines. He knew Ripley, and tells John Ripley's story in the book, The Bridge at Dong Ha. John Miller joins us from his home in Annapolis. And first of all, what did John Ripley do to that bridge?
Well, he rigged it for destruction so that it would drop one span into the river and make it totally unusable. If the bridge had not gone, it would have been curtains for the South Vietnamese. The armored force would have been in Way City by that evening.
Well, he blew the bridge up, but it wasn't as simple as it sounds. Let's hear John Ripley tell his own story. This is from a series called Americans at War, produced by the U.S. Naval Institute. Just let's listen to an excerpt.
Our orders were hold and die. I'll never forget that order. Hold and die. The only way to stop this enormous force with our tiny force was to drop that bridge. I'm dangling under the bridge, hanging by my arms with a full load of explosives. I would drop down out of the steel, grabbing the flanges of the I-beam, swing sideways, and leap over to hand walk all the way out over the river. I crammed over 500 pounds of explosives into each channel. The time fuses detonated. All of a sudden, the shockwave picked me up from behind. It just blew me through the air. And I'm lying on my back, looking skyward, and I can see enormous chunks of this bridge blowing through the air. It was a tremendous feeling. The idea that I would be able to even finish the job before the enemy got me was ludicrous. When you know you're not going to make it, a wonderful thing happens. You stop being cluttered by the feeling that you're going to save your butt.
The late John Ripley, speaking about what he did on April 2nd, 1972, and John Miller, who's written about this story. You've been there. You've walked that bridge. I mean, he left some critical parts out. I mean, it just was amazing when we hear about how he hung the length of this bridge, going across it, trying to get these explosives placed.
It took John 3 hours to rig all these explosives, and he was under constant direct fire the whole time. And while he was up inside the girders of the bridge, they couldn't quite get him. But every time he dropped below to swing to another channel, get another box of TNT, and pull it 100 feet out onto the bridge, he would be taken under direct fire again.
You know, as I was reading his story, I was wondering, if the North Vietnamese could see him, you know, swinging under the bridge and putting these explosives, why didn't they just charge? Why didn't they just cross?
They had tried. And they ran a tank up there, and a lone Vietnamese gunner with a light anti-tank weapon took a shot at him. And here is this young Marine, virtually unprotected. The first shot went high, the second shot hit the tank, disabled its turret, and the tank couldn't really fight anymore. And the North Vietnamese had lost several other tanks because of some gunfire directed by another advisor. And so they were leery. They didn't know what was waiting for them on the other side, and they wanted to regroup and be very careful before they crossed the bridge. This gave Ripley the time that he needed.
So his back was covered by these South Vietnamese Marines. We understand that you and Ripley and the other American advisors were called Covans by the South Vietnamese. It means trusted friend. And in that case, I mean, you had each other's life in your hands.
We had a very tight relationship. Every Covan had to have a successful tour on the battlefield before he could even be considered for the job. And we took a crash course in Vietnamese language before we left. And we wore their uniforms, ate their chow, tried to speak their language as best we could, and just become part of the Vietnamese Marine unit. So we have a very tight relationship, and it continues to this day. We still have reunions with the Vietnamese Marines and the Covans.
Well, in fact, we understand that Major Lee Ba Binh, who was the commander of the Vietnamese 3rd Marine Battalion, attended the funeral on Friday.
Yes, Le Babin was on hand for the funeral. He was one of the honorary pallbearers, as a matter of fact. Also attending was Mrs. Le Nguyen Cong, who is the widow of the Vietnamese Marine Commandant, and a very gracious lady, and she brought the good wishes of all the Vietnamese community to the ceremony.
John Greider Miller, again, who tells the story of what happened on Easter in 1972, what does this story tell us? You know, why don't we know this story? And just your thoughts about what it tells us from beginning to end.
Well, John said it best in his quote about realizing that you weren't going to live through it. And this is a feeling that is common to warriors of all generations. And it was expressed by another company commander who had been overrun. And I asked him what it felt like to be overrun by a hostile force. And he says, well, once you get used to the idea you're going to die, then you're okay. And a calm comes over you. You can function. You can do what has to be done. And this is this warrior spirit that motivated John, and John has passed on to generations of Marines since. He's an inspiration to Marines of every rank, to the midshipmen at the Naval Academy, other would-be Marines, and others who are just friends of Marines. This is a spirit that will really endure forever, and he's been memorialized with a diorama at the Naval Academy, where every plebe, every first-year midshipman gets to learn that story.
And with the diorama, you see him hanging by his hands under the bridge.
That's correct. This is at the entrance to Memorial Hall, which is the holiest of holies at the Naval Academy. The thing that's unusual there is that Ripley was accorded this honor, when he was not only still alive, but still on active duty. Just unheard of.
I guess the other thing I'm taking away is that, you know, well, Vietnam was seen as a war that was lost. It was a controversial war. And so stories like this were not celebrated at the time.
By 1972, the American people wanted to forget about Vietnam. But Ripley epitomized the spirit of the American advisors in general. And after all the U.S. troops had pulled out and there was no mood in the country for U.S. troops to engage in war, the advisors were still there with the Marines, Vietnamese Marines, fighting to the end. And the Vietnamese Marines knew that the advisors would never leave them. They would stay with them to the end. And it's that spirit that binds these two forces together today.
That's retired Marine Colonel John Miller, author of The Bridge at Dong Ha. It tells the story of his friend Marine Colonel John Ripley, who died October 28th and was buried at the U.S. Naval Academy on Friday. And John, so we know you had a sad loss this past Friday, but yesterday you also, with Marines around the world, celebrated the birth of the Corps. And I'm just imagining that he was in your thoughts.
Yes. As we celebrated our 233rd, I know a glass was raised everywhere around the world to toast the memory of John Ripley.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.